box of records.
Let's see what we got on the counter for right. Okay, we'll take up, we'll go ahead and start a tape, I guess.
I know.
And start the meeting at the House Judiciary Committee. It's January 27th. President Ellis, Parnell, Hanley, Grunberg, and Donnelly. And the first matter before us is House Bill 396. Lori, we have the proposed committee substitute before us. It's the 127 lockup version.
Lockup?
Lockup? Do you want me to tell you what's different between this and the last CS?
No. Oh, I see. I'm getting too serious about this job. Yeah, please.
The first change is on page 2, lines 23 to 27. And this is in response to some of the concerns that were raised by Chris Joyce on behalf of the Alaska Action Trust and Public Defender Agency. And this is, in fact, incorporating the recommendation made by the Alaska Action Trust. And that would be to raise the penalty of a felony for a person over 18 to cause physical injury to a child under 10 if the injury reasonably requires medical treatment or causes physical injury to a child under 10 on more than one occasion. So that one instance of causing physical injury to a child that doesn't require medical treatment would not be raised to a felony, would be left as a misdemeanor. Both the Department of Law has also seen this language and felt that this was an appropriate amendment. The next change is on, it's turned to the back, it would be on page 9. It's the addition of the new section 20, and that was in response to some of the issues that we discussed during the committee hearing last Friday, that in imposing a mandatory sentence of 99 years of imprisonment for certain persons, this is to make clear that the legislature did not mean to imply that other people convicted of murder in the first or second degree should not receive a similar sentence in appropriate circumstances, or would eliminate the argument that by imposing a 99-year sentence, a judge needed to make findings other than those that are required by current law to impose a similar sentence on people who aren't included within the mandatory provisions of the statute. The final change that's in the CS is on page 9, line 10, and that is the deletion of, this is the section, to remind you, where a judge is prohibited from referring a case to a three-judge panel based on the defendant's potential for rehabilitation if certain aggravating factors are present. Clearly, the court could still refer one of these cases to the three-judge panel if it found the sentence was manifestly unjust. But one of the factors in aggravation that had been listed was that the person had been adjudicated a delinquent for a felony, and Chris Joyce raised some circumstances where it might not be appropriate to prohibit referral of the case to the three-judge panel if that aggravator were present, so it's been deleted. Although there are a series of amendments before you that also address this issue, and I guess I can talk about them when the amendments come up. But those are the only changes that are in the CS.
Okay, and the CS should also have the trapping exception added to it?
Yes, it has all the amendments that we discussed the other day and that were in the previous CS, and those were to add the language who is or purports to be to the definition of healthcare worker, adding massage therapist, adding trapping, changing the language from moving vehicle to propelled vehicle while the vehicle is being operated, and changing the statute of limitations provisions to those included in the Boyer bill. Finally, adding the amendment on page 10, lines 16 and 17, that a program has to be made available to the defendant by the Department of Corrections before a defendant could be prohibited from receiving discretionary parole for not participating in treatment.
Okay.
So all of those changes that we discussed on Friday that were in the CS we discussed then are also in this bill.
Okay, then I...
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry I wasn't here at Friday's hearing, but could we just go over that final point again about the treatment and availability of treatment?
Sure. That would be, Mr. Chairman and Representative Ellis, on Section 25, the way the bill is structured, the three-judge panel, instead of reducing somebody's sentence outright, would make them eligible for discretionary parole. Section 25 gives the parole board the authority to grant discretionary parole. One of the requirements, starting on line 14, is that line 15, is that the defendant has successfully completed all rehabilitation programs ordered by the three-judge panel. One of the concerns raised by the public defender was that there are circumstances when the Department of Corrections does not make programs available to the defendant, and their parole eligibility should not be dependent on something that is out of their control, i.e. the Department of Corrections making the program available. So we agreed with that affirmation and made an exception to the requirement that the defendant successfully complete all rehabilitation programs to circumstances where the programs are made available to the defendant by the department.
And through the chair, Ms. Otto, do we have any sense of how this will not actually operate, but what the practical case will be in terms of program availability around the state for various people convicted of various crimes? I mean, it's a big question of resources, and do we think that many people will just go on and be eligible and have never had benefit of rehabilitation programs?
It really depends, Mr. Chairman and Representative Ellis, I think, on the kind of treatment programs that a defendant is ordered to undertake. And if you look on page 9, lines 19 and 20, which is the section where the three-judge panel is obligated to order the defendant to engage in appropriate programs for rehabilitation, you can see that it's very broad and it could encompass all kinds of treatment programs. So I really think it depends on where the defendant is housed and what treatment programs are available in that location. Clearly, there are certain kinds of programs that are easier for defendants to get than other kinds of programs. I think that the availability of, you know, just as sort of an observation, I think that the availability of rehabilitation programs is something that is really important to do within the corrections budget, and I'd encourage anybody who has any input to the corrections budget to support funding for rehab programs within the institution.
Yeah. Thanks, Lori. That was going to be my next point. I support the change and appreciate the change in the draft substitute, and it is a matter that I will take up with the Finance Subcommittee for Corrections.
Okay. If there's no further questions about the committee substitute, I entertain a motion to have the committee substitute as the vehicle before us for amendments. Mm-hmm. Any objection? Hearing no objection, motion carries. Now, Lori, we've had prepared a series of potential amendments that have been discussed, right?
Yes, we have.
Okay, I'd like to go ahead and take some.
Pardon? Is it true that the longer the bill, the shorter the time?
Oh, sometimes it has to be. I don't have my sign-up list in front of me. Is there anybody that signed up to testify on the bill today? Gail, did you want to join us? And then I think, Lori, you have somebody in Anchorage to testify?
Mr. Chairman, Barb Briggs from the Public Defender Agency is here. And okay. I think that she wanted to make a couple of comments about the written materials that she submitted to the committee.
Okay, good. All right. Gail, did you want to proceed?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. For the record, my name is Gail Horetsky, Deputy Commissioner in the Department of Public Safety. Unfortunately, sir, we haven't yet seen a CS, so I can't comment on any of the changes that the committee is now considering. I did listen, of course, while Ms. Otto was speaking, and I didn't hear her mention one that we had suggested at an earlier meeting. So for the committee's consideration, I'd like to resuggest it. In the draft of the bill that I have, it would be section 13. I don't know what section is of your CS. And that's the one where it talks about knowingly selling a firearm to a minor.
You for CS.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, that would be on page 6, lines 27 and 28 of the current CS.
Got it.
We had suggested, Mr. Chairman, for the committee's consideration that there be a provision added which prohibits knowingly providing a firearm or defensive weapon to an unemancipated minor under 18 without the consent of the minor's parent or guardian. This would cover giving, lending, or trading a weapon to a minor in addition to selling. Under present AS 11.61.220A3, it is a Class B misdemeanor for an unemancipated minor under 16 to possess a firearm without the consent of a parent or guardian. Mr. Chairman, it seems at least as appropriate to prohibit a person from providing a firearm to a minor as it does to prohibit the minor's possession of it.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Gruber?
Now, let me just make sure that I have... Do you have a draft of that language?
I don't have it prepared as an amendment. I have a draft line in front of me.
Okay, let's go through it, Laura. Knowingly provides, I'm looking at line 27, a firearm or a defensive weapon to an unemancipated minor.
Without the consent of the minor's parent or guardian. And that language, Mr. Chairman and Representative Gruenberg, is basically parroting languages in your draft, page 7, line 5. Which is existing law. Being an unemancipated minor under 16 possesses a firearm without the consent of parent or guardian. So I just took that language and suggested moving it up to page 6, lines 27 and 28. I express no opinion whether it should be 18 or 16. It just seems to me that if you're going to make the kid guilty of a misdemeanor for having it, maybe you ought to prohibit the adult from giving it to him, or bartering it, or trading, or whatever it might be.
Okay, let's focus on the difference in age. Do you see any problem in having two ages being different?
Well, Mr. Chairman, it's my understanding that the new language added on page 6 is basically an acknowledgement of existing federal law, and 18 is taken from that federal law. The present law in Alaska says 16, you can't possess it. It seems to me that that would make sense to make it 18, but I don't even, you know, but that would be just for consistency more than anything else.
Look, focusing for a moment on the language in page 7,
mm-hmm.
16, are we in violation of federal law?
Not that I'm aware of, sir, because I believe federal law addresses selling it to a minor.
My understanding is correct.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. Federal law addresses only sales of firearms. And in fact, federal law, it's illegal to sell a handgun to somebody who's under 21. But the federal law really does only address sales and not possession.
Well, now, so under federal law, it is legal. Under federal law, you cannot sell a handgun to anyone under 21.
Yeah, or any firearm to anyone under 18.
Right, or a long gun to anyone under 18.
Okay, focusing back on the handgun versus the firearm, do we want to have anything in here to track federal law with respect to the handgun?
No, well, my opinion is not, because the federal law had opposition, and a lot of folks out there felt that the age majority should have been the age for both long guns and handguns. So if the feds want to enforce that 3 more years, I say let them do it. The state seems to be a sensible prohibition for sale for both those kind of weapons for under 18.
Firearm includes handguns and rifles?
Yes.
Yes.
At this time, Mr. Chairman, I realize that maybe you had more testimony.
No, sir.
Okay. At this time, I would like to move an amendment on page 6, lines 27, 28, in the line of what Ms. Horesky said, to change it to read, knowingly provides a firearm or a defensive weapon to an unemancipated minor under 18 years of age without the consent of the parent or guardian. Once again, knowingly provides a firearm or a defensive weapon to an unemancipated minor under 18 years of age without the consent of the parent or guardian.
How about written consent?
Well, okay. How do you feel about written?
Existing law doesn't require written, and I'm not aware of difficulties in enforcing that. I mean, if the parent says, my dad said I could have it, check with the dad and find out if he said that. Either way, it's a policy.
I just guess I'd rather see that it's in writing so that you don't have to depend on he said it, she said it, they said it.
I would accept that as a friendly amendment if that's agreeable with the chair.
That's why you don't want to make it.
So without the written consent. Now, just a question. This would allow either parent to do it, whether it's a custodial or the non-custodial parent. Mm-hmm. And I want that clear. It doesn't have to be the custodial parent.
Okay, so we've got the amendment before us, and then we have discussion. I'm going to speak against the amendment. I think it's going to cause a lot of problems, and I think it's a lot cleaner to leave it as something that everybody can agree on. That's it. You shouldn't be able to buy firearms if you're a minor. And this is going to cause, although it's, I know why people would want this, and I commend them for, you know, that there is a public safety problem that would address. I think the scope of this would really impact a lot of other things that are illegal activities that we don't want to negatively impact, I think hunting and other types of recreational activities with firearms. I know the Outdoor Council would oppose this. I've met with them. If they were here today, I can represent to the committee that they would be opposed. And I also believe the National Rifle Association would oppose it too.
Mr. Chairman?
What's the problem where it sells in contrast to provides?
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, the problem is, there are two problems, and I think maybe part of it has to do with the written thing. Because you can, let's say you're going hunting with a friend and his kid, and you loan him a shotgun. Then, that's the difference between providing and selling. But I'm sorry, without the and to be legal under this, we'd have to have the person's written consent. So I'm not sure I should have said the written. I think it may have been better left without the written. But the other thing is you're going to have people who are going to be transferring. You know, the criminals are going to be transferring weapons, and they're going to say technically it's not a sale. That's a barn door, a loophole. So I like the word provides. I'm not so sure that we want to keep the word written in. I think I may have agreed too soon.
Well, I appreciate that. Mr. Chairman, I understand what you're saying about the term sell. Maybe the maker of the motion here, Representative Greenberg, would like to have a seventh, which acknowledges the criminal portion, and allow that to be under the term provision rather than sells, and convert the provide here to sells. And leave in written, then it wouldn't be a problem. So you'd be addressing the selling problem and having that handled in writing, and that addresses the retail operation or wholesale operation for sales. And then you can go into seven and address the criminal concern that you have and put your language in that you'd like it under number seven.
Well, a sale is a category you can provide without selling. But
that's
anytime
right.
You sell, you are providing.
That's right.
So you're saying you would say you can't sell it without the written consent, but you can provide it without the written consent.
I'm saying address sell and written under six, and then whatever you would like to do to address the concern for the criminal transfer that you suggested.
Mr. Chairman?
Ms. Reskey, would like
to. Yeah, hang on a second, Lori.
If,
Gail,
Mr.
Want?
Chairman, if federal law prohibits sale, then you can't make it okay with parental consent. Federal law prohibits sale.
Lori, could you hear that comment?
Mr. Reskey took the words right out of my mouth. The selling is an absolute prohibition. It doesn't matter whether or not there's consent. And in fact, we could not authorize selling guns to people underage with written consent because it's a violation of federal law. So Mr. Reskey and I are tracking.
So it doesn't have to be. So then my written request is not.
Well, no.
Get all you heard before I made
no. Because federal law, they are not inconsistent. They would be read that you can't sell a firearm, period. But you could do other kinds of providing as long as you have the written consent. That's the way it would be read. So I therefore think the language is okay. And I'm sorry if the NRA takes the position that they want kids to be having guns without their parents' consent. I don't think that's good public policy. And I'll stand by my amendment as it's written with the Barnett amendment.
I'm further disappointed in my written
Oh, you withdraw that?
The written portion.
Okay, then that's agreeable with me.
Okay, if we've got unanimous consent that written's out of that, I'll allow it. Okay, written's out of it. Okay. Is there further discussion on this amendment? Then?
Do we need to act on this today?
Yeah, I'm going to speak to it if there's no other discussion.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to make a comment if I could.
Go ahead.
I just would like to point out for the committee's information, and you can discuss whether or not you want to make another change if the amendment passes, that if you look on the language on page 7, line 5, we're saying that a person under the age of 16 can't possess a firearm without the consent of a parent or guardian. So if you're saying in the amendment that somebody can't provide a firearm to somebody who's under 18, we're creating a fairly anomalous situation where it's not illegal for the minor to have it. The minor can legally possess a weapon, but somebody can't legally provide it to them. So that if you are going to do the amendment, I believe that you should either use the age 16 in the amendment or amend the language on page 7, line 5 to be 18, one or the other. But having one be 18 and one be 16, I think is inconsistent.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative, what I'm going to propose is that the amendment be before us be a new line, say a line 7, just on page 6, line, in between 28 and 29, just for clarity, because 6 is okay the way it is, but if we want to have a 7, then we just say, knowingly provides a firearm or defensive weapon without the consent of the parent to someone, and then right now it'd be 18, but we have a separate section there.
That's real.
Now the discussion raised by Lori is whether it should be 16 or 18. How does the maker of the amendment feel about that?
I feel they should be consistent. And I think they should be 18.
Okay.
Yes.
So that means we leave your amendment the way it is for this discussion. Okay.
And I would also, as part of that, move to be consistent that we change 16 on page 7, line 5 to 18. That we consider that.
Okay, I'll allow that be part of the amendment, too. Okay, so where we're at now, we've been joined by
Representative
Miller and Representative Martin.
That was an additional move. I mean, I would like...
You want them separate?
Well, just so we can do the 16 versus 18 and then...
Okay, then without unanimous
like
consent, we have another amendment before us, and without unanimous consent, we can't amend your amendment, so we'll leave it the way it is.
Wait, it strikes me that... Let me make the suggestion. That we have it in bed, as it was, and then you can move the change from 16 to the 18. I mean, 18 to 16. And we'll vote on his thing first.
Mr. Chairman, I think we're making this a whole lot more confusing than we need to. We have an amendment before us. There was an objection. Why don't we just discuss that?
That's
either up
I'd
or
like
down?
I'd like to go up or down with it, and then we can make a conforming amendment
there.
If it passes. Right. Yeah, okay. That's what my ruling is going to be.
Does that include the 18 on this page?
Well, that's the way you made it on page 6 was to be 18.
And so part of my motion is this language, too.
That
this be
changed. That didn't come until much later. So we'll take that up a second.
That's okay.
Because there was an objection to doing it by unanimous consent.
Okay.
At this moment, we're voting on whether or not, and Representative Martin, maybe you could follow me through this. We're on page 6,
mm-hmm.
in between lines 28 and 29, adding a new section 7, saying to prohibit knowingly providing a firearm or defensive weapon without the consent of the parent or guardian
to an
unemancipated minor under the age of 18.
I'm going to change my amendment. I'm going to do this in a two-step. I'm going to first do it for 16, and if we're successful at 16, then I'll move a second time to make it 18.
Is there any objection to that? Okay, if there's no objection, then the way it'll read, the amendment before us is a new section 7 there, line 28, knowingly provides a firearm or defensive weapon without the consent of parent or guardian to an unemancipated minor under the age of 16.
Right.
Is that accurate?
That's correct.
Okay.
I'll object
on the amendment.
Yeah, I will object for discussion because that, basically does...
For example, are you objecting to this, him changing it to 16, or are you objecting to the amendment?
I'm objecting to the amendment.
Okay. Proceed, please. Yeah.
Okay. That is two entirely concepts. Sell is one concept and provide is a totally different concept. And, I don't know, this is a honey state. I mean, even target practicing, maybe I want to take my kids out for a little bit of target practicing and when their friends come along, maybe I should get the consent of the parent, so I let them, try the .22 out on the target. I don't necessarily think that should be a criminal offense.
Yeah.
But they are, in that circumstance, the kid is then in violation of the law even though you aren't. Because under current law, if they're unemancipated under 16, they can't possess a firearm. So what we're saying is it probably needs to be, and I tend to support that, it needs to be consistent. If they can't possess one, then you shouldn't be able to, without their parents' consent, and someone else shouldn't be able to provide them one to make the child guilty of a crime versus, and not the person providing it as well.
Let me ask a question here. I want to get to you, Representative Martin. But do you think the Department of Public Safety or Department of Law would consider a child being in possession if there was a supervising adult, they were there while they provided the firearm to the child, say out at the target range, would DPS or Department of Law want to prosecute that child for being in possession even though there was an immediate supervision of an adult there? It doesn't seem the kind of thing we're getting at here with that statute, does it? I just wanted to ask that because it might clarify that point, the term possess.
I think they might. I'm going to give you an example. Let's say you got a group of kids running around. They haven't committed any other crime yet, but they're obviously looking for something to shoot, whether it's a sign or a person or something, and they're pulled over on a traffic stop. I think they might very well get them for minor in the possession of a firearm.
Right, that's different than my example.
I'm sorry.
My example was where there was a supervising adult hand the firearm to the child at the rifle range, and the child
shoots. As an adult
shoots.
Okay. Let me change your hypo slightly. Let's say one of them happens to be slightly over the age of 18 and be an adult, or over the age of 21. You got a group of buddies. One of them happens to be slightly under the age. One of them happens to be slightly over the age. It would seem to me that that wouldn't be much of a defense.
Okay, Representative Martin. Sorry.
I really think that this may color up the clog up your whole law. I've been on a trip with Boys Club kids, and we did go out hiking and things like that. And that time, you know, you teach them safety with bears, you teach them safety with wild animals, whatever. And at times you have people with it, have one of the troopers say, here's your time to guard in the back, you know. Or what about in a real emergency? If someone gets injured and you quickly give the rifle or pistol to a kid,
let me respond. You
know, I think it's more natural, as Mike said, in this state to have a arm for the sake of self-defense. And that's what you teach people and you teach kids to go out. Did you get permission from the parents each time? Probably not. It's just assumed that you're going to do as a scout leader, as we took kids out on camping trips, that you do the best to protect them. And part of that is, we used to give them radios, and we used to give them cans with stones in it as a defense method. If that don't work, here's a pistol.
Representative Grimberg.
Two things. First of all, let's say that there is a necessity that, you know, you're attacked by a bear or something. Give the kid a rifle or something. That's a valid defense. There's no question about that. That the test of the defense of necessity is that the danger that causes the crime to be committed is a more serious danger than the crime itself. And here you're defending life. And so that clearly would be a defense. With respect to the scoutmaster, I think that scoutmasters, and I was a Boy Scout for a long time and was involved. I think that any responsible scoutmaster, if they're going to be giving out weapons, darn well better get the parents' consent. They shouldn't be having kids with weapons without making sure the parents are on board, and that this is just a responsible thing to do. It's not a big thing, speaking as a parent of two widely divergent in ages sons, I certainly would want to know if somebody's given my kid a weapon.
Well, sure you would, and good person who always tried to do that, but a couple times in packing up this and packing up that and getting a dozen kids going, and you do see a rifle in the back of the car and you see them in the back of the truck. No, you didn't specifically ask mom and dad, but they saw it there. So, well, you know, an accident happens, and later on you're sued. Maybe you have to write that down for all Boy Scouts, Boy Club leaders, or people who take kids, even school teachers on hikes. But you do teach, and it's not necessarily with the bullet in the weapon, kids how to protect each other or groups when you go hiking. And so you're going to transfer the rifle. It gives the kid a good sense of maturity when you say, oh, it's your time now to hold a rifle. There may not be nothing in there, but it might give them a good feeling.
My recollection, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My recollection is, and Bruce, when he was a kid, took a course in rifle safety at the Boys Club. They got my permission, and the thing was done properly. I think that's good common sense. You don't give kids weapons.
If there's no further discussion, before we take the vote, I'd just like to say one thing for the record. I don't think the NRA supports the unsupervised children having firearms. What they're afraid of here is that this will restrict a lot of legal and clearly appropriate activities also that might be being conducted.
I have no problem if you can come up with some kind of concrete example that we should have as language in here that would provide them with some comfort. But here, if you don't have something like that, then people are going to be able to give weapons to kids and just claim that they didn't sell it to them. And you're going to have them arming the children. And in another part of the bill, you're saying that on school grounds they shouldn't be armed. I think that you're going to have kids armed, not armed on school grounds and armed elsewhere. And we just polled some of the principals in our district and they came unglued when you talked about letting them kids even have a defensive weapon. And I'd like to make sure that all members of the committee are here. I'd like to see that Representative Barnell.
Well, he gave me a note, said he had another meeting. I can't really go order him to be here. Representative Martin.
Well, again, on the same point, there doesn't seem to be any need. There's no overwhelming crisis within the community or the state to show that we need to ensure that happening. You mentioned a couple of years ago, don't clutter up the malls, the bad enough now, but things that aren't necessary. I don't see the need for this. It looks like in the state we've been most successful with responsibility.
Kids with guns seems to be a big issue in my community.
I'll propose this, Representative Grimberg. If the vote is by less than a margin of two, then we'll wait for Representative Parnell to get back and reconsider it.
All right.
Okay. So if his vote would make a difference.
That's reasonable.
Yeah. Are we prepared to vote on this? I think the proposal before us is between 28 and 29, add new section 7, which I think I stated and the sponsor agrees with. We all understand the concept? All right, those in favor of adding the amendment, indicate. Okay, three, those opposed. All right, we'll hold it then, available for you to make again when Representative Parnell returns.
Yeah, and I would just ask that we re-vote at that point.
That's fine.
Can I add a quick comment? I mean, to me, the biggest problem with this is if we're gonna have, we need to make the law consistent. And if you want to propose eliminating the other section, then I may be willing to consider that as well. But I don't think making it illegal for a minor to possess and allowing an adult to provide, I don't think that's inconsistent in the statutes. And I think we need to make the statutes consistent either way.
Okay.
And Mr. Chairman, if there's language that more artfully conforms to different people's scenarios of kids with guns, good kids with guns and bad kids with guns, I'd be interested in entertaining that in the future as well. But okay. That may not be possible enough.
I do want to clarify here, Representative Hanley, that the language that appears in the next section here, the section 14, that's existing law.
I am.
Okay, so we're not adding that. The only thing that this bill originally proposed to do was just conform with the federal law and say you couldn't sell it to somebody under age of 18. So we
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, Lori?
Could I ask through the chair a question of Ms. Retzke?
Sure.
We had some fairly strong testimony from Chief O'Leary. Likewise, there's been a number of newspaper articles about the problems created in Anchorage in particular by selling defensive weapons to minors. That's the reason that the change to the statute is being made. I would ask Ms. Retzke through the chair if there's been any problem with providing weapons to minors, if that's something that is designed to address a particular problem.
Yes, please.
Mr. Chairman, in response to Ms. Otto's question, I am not aware of any specific problem with providing as opposed to selling. Minors possessing firearms without the knowledge or consent of their parents is something that does concern us and is something that clearly has been run into on the school grounds in Anchorage, for example. My concern was in the interests, in part, of consistency. For example, we have a law now that says if you're a minor, you can't consume alcohol, and if I run a 7-Eleven, I can't sell it to you either. But in the existing law, that's right. In existing law, we say you're a minor, you can't drink alcohol, but it's okay if I give it to you or sell it to you. And that just seems so crazily anomalous. This provision, so far as I'm aware, has been in there since this criminal code was adopted originally in 1978. So this provision about if you're a child, you can't have it, has been in there for 9 to 15 years.
Mr. Chairman, you and I were talking about whether word unsupervised would do it. I think that's moving in the right direction, but I want to be sure that we don't happen to have a situation where we got a carload of kids, one of whom happens to be over the age of majority, and says, sure, I didn't commit this crime, I was supervising it. But we just happened to kill a few people while I was supervising
them. Yeah, and I guess my point was there's going to be a lot of other crimes involved there at that point. More serious than simply providing the firearm.
Yeah, so my
and besides providing the firearm, if there had been a murder, create an accomplice situation also.
Yeah,
so
it was a lousy hypo. They hadn't killed him.
So anyhow, the track that I was working on there was to distinguish those circumstances where somebody, an adult, is with the child when they give them the firearm to practice rifle or to hunt, versus those times where they just give them it and it's theirs to take. You know,
I would ask, maybe Ms. Otto and Ms. Horesky can work on something that would address that concern, because that's moving down the road. I just want the language to be tight.
Okay. Representative Martin.
Mr. Chairman, let's get back to this page 7, subsection 3, where we're talking about minors not having weapons. Isn't it assumed, you know, adults will not cause kids to break the law? So, couldn't you say it was implied? Anyone giving a kid a weapon at 16 is guilty?
No, sir.
Do you help it? Well, what's this about the aiding a minor in a commission of a crime?
Contributing
to a crime. Well, what would be worse? Contributing to a crime?
That would be contributing.
I'd have to double check. I think
it would. Is that a misdemeanor, though?
Yes.
This is what we've done makes it a felony.
If you want to make that a felony,
the language on that.
Mr. Chairman, this is a Class A misdemeanor that we're debating.
Misconduct?
The amendments in Section 13 are amendments to misconduct involving weapons in the second degree, which is a Class A misdemeanor. The existing language relating to a minor possessing a firearm is a Class B misdemeanor.
May I ask Ms. Otto a question?
Yes.
Lori, this is Max. Is contributing a misdemeanor or what?
It's 1151-130 And I believe that it's a misdemeanor. I'm looking it up right now. Yes, that it's a Class A misdemeanor. Mm-hmm.
So if somebody did this under existing law, that's already contributing and that's a misdemeanor?
Yes.
I'd ask, under those conditions, may I inquire, Ms. Oreskes? Ms. Oreskes, given that that's already a crime, do we need to put this on the books here, too?
Be redundant.
Yeah, it might be redundant.
Well, the effect would be to change it from a misdemeanor to a felony.
No.
No,
this is a misdemeanor, too. Same thing.
Oh, that's right. It is a misdemeanor.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, 1151-130, subsection A1 says a person commits a crime contributing if being 19 or older, so you have a person 19 or older, aids, induces, causes, or encouraging a child under 18 to do any act prohibited by state law. So then the question is, have you aids, induced, caused, or encouraged a child under 18? And that's an A misdemeanor. You would have to show culpable mental state of knowing, but of course people are implied to know the law. So that would be...
So I think under those conditions, I would like to move... I'm just going to... Let's drop my amendment.
Okay.
But on the other hand, it seems to me that if you... The language in Section 6 is unnecessary also, because that's also contributing. Except it's under 18. That's the only difference between that and what we have here on page 3, lines 5
and 6. Mr. Chairman, can I respond to that?
Yeah, Ms. Otto.
It is not a crime for a person who is under 18 to possess a defensive weapon unless they possess the defensive weapon on school grounds. So this is not the same situation, and as has been testified to earlier, is a big problem in Anchorage. The only reason we added firearm in, this whole section was added to address defensive weapons. The only reason we added in firearms is because it is a crime under federal law. It seemed to be unusual to be making it a crime to sell defensive weapons under state law without making it also a crime to sell firearms. So it is not flat out a crime for a minor to possess a defensive weapon, and that's why we're making it illegal to sell it to them.
Okay, we
seem to give it to them.
Figured it out. Yeah, it'd be okay to give them a defensive weapon.
Okay, give them.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so what's the next proposed amendment?
And that's okay.
Yeah, I think we figured it out. That's good. This was a good roundabout discussion. The next amendment that we had that I see relates to Representative Martin's amendment. Lori, is that the one you've got?
I think that what was going on is that you were taking testimony and you took the testimony from Ms. Horesky. So did you want to take the testimony from Ms. Brink before we went to the amendments, or did you want to do that later?
Let's have Ms. Brink, and then we'll take it up.
For the record, this is Barbara Brink. I'm with the Alaska Public Defender Agency. I again appreciate this opportunity to be heard. The Public Defender Agency has submitted a position paper, which is quite lengthy, and I just wanted to appear today and take a couple minutes of your time to draw some attention to one point that I think is particularly critical, and that has to do with the amendment of Section 20 and limiting the discretion of the three-judge panel. I do know, having been provided today a copy of the position paper by the Alaska Action Trust, that our positions on this are consistent. That is, we urge that the legislature not do piecemeal modifications of the current Alaska statutes with regard to sentencing. I think that the legislative body created the Alaska Sentencing Commission. They are working hard to try to find a holistic, wholesale approach, taking into account all of the factors that needed to be addressed, and that I think it would be premature to make any small modifications to the sentencing scheme without seeing what the Sentencing Commission had to recommend based on their exhaustive studies. Particularly with respect to this provision, I went to the Alaska Judicial Council and pulled some of the Sentencing Commission reports and memoranda concerning the particular non-statutory mitigator of unusual prospects for rehabilitation. But the effect of the amendment to Section 20 would be to remove the discretion of the three-judge panel to alter a sentence where the reason the case was referred to the three-judge panel has been that this particular offender has unusually good potential to be rehabilitated. We're not talking about your average offender who should do the presumptive term, but a person who has already established, at least in front of one judge, by clear and convincing evidence, that they are excellent prospects for rehabilitation. Typically, a memo that I looked at had the data that found out how many cases were referred to the three-judge panel in the entire state of Alaska. The case that established this mitigator came out in 1985. Since that time, only a total of 75 cases from throughout the state have been referred to the three-judge sentencing panel on the basis of unusually good prospects for rehabilitation. Of those 75 cases, the three-judge panel accepted the court's conclusion and in fact found that the offender had unusually good prospects in only 39 cases. So, in many of those cases referred to them, they reanalyzed the situation and found that that mitigator had not been proven and rejected the idea of modifying the sentence based on these good prospects for rehabilitation. Even in those few cases where unusual prospects for rehabilitation were proven again in front of the three-judge panel by clear and convincing evidence, that did not always result in a sentence being modified. Sometimes the presumptive sentence was imposed anyway. Sometimes the presumptive sentence was imposed, but a portion of it was suspended. In all of the sex offender cases referred under this mitigating factor, the grand total was only 15. In the majority of those cases, the three-judge panel again rejected that mitigating factor, finding that not to be proven. So out of all of the total sex offender cases sent to the three-judge panel, only 7 cases were found by the three-judge panel to have that unusually good potential for rehabilitation. And even in those cases, the three-judge panel generally recommended sex offender treatment both while incarcerated and as a condition of probation. I think that what this points out is a problem that I see in amending bits and pieces of this legislation. We have exhaustive studies that are being done. We have a lot of information that's being assimilated. We have a lot of data being gathered and analyzed. And what we are doing if we try to fix small things that we perceive to need correction now is we are not able to take into account the entire picture. And therefore, I would again ask and join in the request of the Alaska Action Trust Act that this committee not recommend any modifications of the sentencing code and wait until the sentencing commission has finished their study. Another good example of how this would work is that the amendment proposed in section 25 to only put the onus on the defendant to complete these rehabilitation programs if they're provided by corrections, that doesn't fix the problem. In fact, the Alaska Sentencing Commission December of 1991 submitted their report to the governor and the legislature, and they spent at least 4 pages discussing treatment programs within facilities. I can't give you a summary of what that conclusion was because it was a broad-based topic, but they heard from people in sex offender treatment programs, they heard from people from alcohol treatment programs, they talked to people in and out of the correctional system, and I think that their input would be a valuable information to this committee in finding out what programs were made available and what was not made available. And I would urge this committee not to.
But I thought that the response by the Mr. Twinkier gets way far away from what the original intent was, and that is murder. I'm not worried about rehabilitation of rapists or rehabilitation of other crimes. I'm worried about murder. And it just seems to me that it is less acceptable by the public to kill an innocent child or torture a senior citizen than therefore an officer of the law to be killed in the line of duty or a fireman to be killed. And that's where I'm coming from, that that's a crime that's completely unacceptable. And so if you're going to, you know, say someone gets 99 years for killing a police officer in the line of duty, or even by accident or a fireman, then I think the killing of the innocent child, like a 14-year-old boy in Fairbanks that was killed, that person should get 99 years.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman?
No, not...
I think we're talking about different amendments. You said the Martin Amendment.
Yeah, I understand what's going on here, but...
And I might have misspoken. I was referring specifically to Section 22.
Yeah, I understand, but your comments also ran to any changes in sentencing, and so yeah. I think Representative Martin's expressing his support for his proposed amendment.
Oh, that's what I thought.
But I think it's appropriate, because her remarks also went to any changes in sentencing also. Okay. Did anybody else wish to address that? Okay. Then thank you.
Wait, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Grunberg.
Ms. Brink, do you have in front of you the 127 proposed committee substitute?
Yes, I do.
Okay, so specifically, which sections are you objecting to?
Well, wanted to direct my remarks at sections 21 and 22 specifically.
Is that it?
Well, let me, this is the first chance I've had an opportunity to see the draft, and so if I could butt in for a second.
It would also be portions of the amendments in section 23, the amendment in section 24, and the amendment in section 25.
Correct.
And you're suggesting we basically delete those and await the Sentencing Commission's recommendation?
I think that I can make my comments more narrowly drawn. The data that I was able to compile regarding the three-judge panel, it appears to me, and I'll ask Ms. Otto's assistance, to apply directly to those changes made in Section 22 and 23, 24, and 25. Actually, more specifically, sections 22 and 25.
Okay, well, I'm just trying to figure out what you want done. You want 22 and 25 out, and that's it?
Well, Representative Grunberg, the difficulty is that there are conforming amendments that would need to be made in 23, and 24 would also be deleted if you delete 22 and 25. There are technical amendments in other portions of the statute as a result of the amendments in 22 and 25. I think what Ms. Brink is saying is the substantive amendments that she has particularly objected to at this point are the amendments in 22 and 25.
But you, but you do that whole series to do it right.
Pardon me?
You do the whole series, 21, 22, 23, 24, and 25, if you...
Well, I actually think that, I mean, I understand that Ms. Brink is objecting to 21, but it's a different kind of objection. You know, I think that the issues raised by 21 are separate issues, personally, than the issues raised in 22, part of 23, 24, and 25. And I keep saying part of 23 because the sections of 23 that are on lines 29 and 30 are necessitated by the 99-year mandatory term for certain murders. The amendment of 23 on line 25 goes along with 25. So.
I understand. You're talking about the language on page 9, line 25. The language on page 9, lines 29 and 30 relates to something else.
Okay. So that just by page and line number, on this particular point, I don't mean to mischaracterize Ms. Brink's testimony that she supports the rest of the bill, but on the point that she's making right now, we would delete page 9, lines 12 through 25, and then starting again on page 9, line 31, through page 10, line 17. All of that would go.
I understand. And the argument is basically, in 25 words or less, that the Sentencing Commission mm-hmm. hasn't completed its work. Right?
May I speak, Mr. Chairman? This is Barbara Brink again.
Yeah, go ahead, Ms. Brink.
That is basically it, although I would elaborate upon it a little more. They have done work, they have held meetings, and they have discussed these specific questions. And until we understand the recommendations with regard to this section, I believe shouldn't be included.
Okay. May I ask one more question?
Representative Grunberg.
This, I guess, is to Ms. Otto or somebody who wants this language in. Why shouldn't we wait until the commission, which we've established, does its work? Why do we need to do this instantly?
Mr. Chairman, should I respond to that?
Go ahead.
I think that the legislature, since it created the Sentencing Commission, has passed a number of statutes that affect mm-hmm. the sentences that people receive for crime. I think the Sentencing Commission is looking at the system overall. It's not looking at individual problems that arise in the criminal justice system. I think that the legislature is intelligent enough to independently evaluate issues that come before it. I think the issue here is fairly straightforward. If you have somebody that's facing sentencing who has a good potential for rehabilitation, should you reduce their sentence at the time of sentencing, or should you change, which is what the existing law says, that there's the potential for having the sentence reduced at the time of sentencing, or instead, should you give them the possibility of having their sentence reduced at a later date if they comply with the requirements of their sentence? I think that from a public policy point of view, that it is far better to evaluate after the fact whether or not somebody has been rehabilitated and to leave them with the incentive of becoming rehabilitated rather than reducing their sentence up front.
I understand, if I may, Mr. Chairman. Did I misunderstand Ms. Brink to say that the commission was specifically looking at this problem. It wasn't just a general thing, as you've said, Ms. Otto, but they are very specifically looking at this problem. Isn't that what you said, Ms. Brink?
This is Ms. Otto again, and I think Ms. Horesky, who's in the room, is on the Sentencing Commission, and is probably best able to evaluate that. I have sat through the Sentencing Commission meetings, and they have considered the issue of extraordinary potential for rehabilitation, and they have not been able to come to a consensus as to what should be done to deal with the problem. Various proposals have been made. It's not been broken out into even one proposal or another proposal. People can't agree on that. The statistics that Ms. Brink was talking about were gathered to aid the Sentencing Commission in dealing with that issue, but they were not able to reach consensus. As I said, Ms. Horesky is on the Sentencing Commission. You can ask her to talk about what the Sentencing Commission is specifically doing on that point.
Yeah, just because they haven't so far, they've got a ways to go before they give out their report. That doesn't mean they won't be able to do it. If they're still in the midst, it seems to me that we've established this commission, we ought to get the benefit of their thinking, but I'd like to...
Representative Mark.
Well, it's kind of what comes first, Carter, before the horse. In this case here, I was wondering if anyone has any idea how long the commission is going to be to finish this sentence report, and perhaps with these two sections remaining in there, this may give them something more to evaluate, and that if the committee feels that this is the right direction that legislature should go, let's leave it in there. We have plenty of time down the road. If they're going to do their job within 90 days, I don't know, but I like to leave these in there, and if the commission seriously has problems with it, they can tell the other group or whatever. I feel safe with leaving it there now. That didn't give us a time.
Mr. Chairman, by statute, the Sentencing Commission sunsets in 1993.
Yeah. Well, I meant, in other words, you want us to wait till 1993 to do the report?
No, I don't think she's asking us
for
that.
Mr.
Chairman. Okay. Yeah, Lori. Okay. I've had. Okay. Ms. Brink? Ms. Brink?
Sir?
Yeah. Maybe you guys could just wait till I call on you this time, okay? Because I want to try to get something done here. So, the one thing I'd like to state for the record as far as the question that Representative Grunberg asked, who could argue for doing something now rather than waiting, is the fact that I voted for the Sentencing Commission. But when I voted for the Sentencing Commission, I never did so on the condition that I would give up my responsibilities or my rights as a legislator to pursue changes in sentencing statutes for the state of Alaska. And that obligation continues parallel to that of the Sentencing Commission. And I feel a duty where I see something wrong and not working, and I think a large majority of the public perceive that also, to pursue corrections for that and not sit and wait for the commission to decide if they may or may not agree with that. So as far as a position, I voted for it, but I certainly never would have done so if I felt the argument would have been made that we could do nothing while they existed. So it's just that question was asked, and I wanted to answer it, you know, just from as an argument. At this point, I think we pretty well understand Representative Hanley.
I was just going to suggest that we take specific amendments. If someone has an amendment on that issue,
it's exactly what I was going to suggest at this point in time.
Let's go through the other amendments sure. that we have already before us and see if we can.
Well, I'm going to, at some point when you want to offer to accept an amendment on this point, I will make it. I don't know if you want to weigh in with what you're
talking. As long as we've already had this discussion, why don't you go ahead and make your amendment now?
Okay. And I move to. Well, may I ask Ms. Horesky one question?
Sure.
Ms. Horesky, you're on the Sentencing Commission. When do you anticipate that commission would be able to make a recommendation on this particular point?
Mr. Chairman, Gail Horesky, the commission has issued a report. It's the second report. They issued one last year. I just got it today, so I think you'll be getting it, you know, in a minute now. The commission, that report that just came out today doesn't have a recommendation on this issue. The commission anticipates two more reports, Mr. Chairman, one in January of 93 and one in June of 93. The commission sunsets in 18 more months. So it's looking at those two more reports. Now, what recommendation either of those will contain on this issue, I couldn't say.
If the legislature were to ask the commission, is the commission going to be meeting during this legislative session?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that there was an appointment set up on the 7th of February to have the Sentencing Commission meet with legislative committees, and I guess I had thought that included the judiciary. So you'll be hearing from the commission on February 7th.
Do you think it's realistic for the legislature to request an expedited review and recommendation on this point during this legislative session?
Mr. Chairman, the legislature could provide whatever direction is appropriate to the Sentencing Commission. We have been talking about this issue for The difficulty is coming up.
Mr. Chairman, it is less important to me whether or not this language comes in, stays in, than that we, by a motion of this committee, and I'll make this as a motion at this time, request, and I'm not going to move to delete this language at this point, but I am going to make the following motion, that we request the Sentencing Commission to, on an expedited basis, consider this issue and report back to this committee and any other committee which is likely to have jurisdiction over this bill as to these particular sections. I'd like the benefit of their thinking. I'm not going to move to delete, but I'd like the benefit of their thinking, and we ask them to do it during this legislative session on as quick a basis as possible. That's my motion.
Is there any objection to the
I will object to it, just okay. Simple fact. What about if another committee down the road asks for another question, another committee asks for another question? Every question before them is going to be expedited. You know, we've given them a job, let them do it, we give them a time frame, so let them do it in, let them do it in. Well, we may not agree with any of their suggestions that they come back with, but I just could see a snowballing effect, you know, us just asking every different committee asking to expedite one little portion until they have to expedite everything.
Okay, Representative Mark.
Mr. Chairman, on the question of that, I don't know how realistic it is to get the members of the commission together, or even give them the question or the history behind it or whatever, in less than 9 days. Days the 27th, I mean, the 7th, you know, less than seven working days at the most. How realistic it is to demand your member of the committee, how hard can you get to them?
Commission is not scheduled to meet again until that February meeting. So
yeah.
We'll be here with them.
So what would you do? Is there lots of Senator to the homes and each of them? Yeah. How could they meet together?
Okay. Well, Representative Groom.
Yeah. Two things. First of all, I don't see, if we have any questions other than this, we would meld it together in a single letter. This bill goes from here to the Finance Committee. If they or anybody else happen to have a similar question, they do it. I think it's unlikely. I think it's the kind of thing the committee can handle. I don't think that that's a serious thing. I would hope we would like to have a thing. I think that's just good policy. I'm not saying anything that has to be done before the 7th. I'm talking about this legislative session, and if it say the bill happens to be out of the House, then it may be something that would be pursued in the Senate. Mm-hmm. That nameless other body.
Well, if you open the plan, that's okay. Thought you were shooting for the
okay.
Second.
No.
Well, with that understanding, I will withdraw that. I still think you could run into a problem. Okay, what's to stop the Senate Judiciary Committee asking a pile of questions? What's to stop House Finance? I mean, they're thinking individuals. Mm-hmm. They may have questions.
It's inappropriate to ask questions.
Okay. Well, it could be inappropriate to try to, you know, the Senate Commission to expedite all these different, but I will drop my objections to it.
Okay, thank you, Representative Miller. With that, if there's no objection, we will draft such a letter to the Sentencing Commission. Okay. The next amendment I have before us is a variation of the issue that Representative Martin brought before us. Representative Martin, do you have this? It's the lockup 12792 proposed amendment regarding to the torture and murder of children. Yeah, there's a packet of amendments
okay,
that we've drafted up trying to put proposals that people had talked
there
about.
There was one here. They've numbered these countries. So you're talking about number one.
Yeah, it's V1.
And then there was another one by Mark.
Right. I don't know if Representative Martin intends to continue that one or not.
Yeah.
If you would prefer to take yours up first, Representative Martin, if you still feel strongly about it.
It looks like what they did on the amendment here, it looks good to me. Page one, sub one, where they took care of both problems and they changed that word so that it meets the, I guess, legal ramifications. Victims of gratuitous torture. Or whatever
Representative Martin, if you would you like to make this amendment?
Yeah, I'd like to put forward move this amendment to.
Okay. Representative Gruber.
I support the concept, but for the purposes of discussion, I object because this is going to, as in Representative Martin's favorite phrase, be a lawyer's dream. I would love to litigate the issue of what's gratuitous as opposed to paid for torture. Gratuitous generally means you give it away free.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to respond to that.
Okay, counsel, respond to that.
What is intended by this phrase, and I'm glad you're giving me the opportunity to speak so that we can create a record of legislative intent here, is torture that was unnecessary to the act of killing. The problem is that we have cases that say, for example, shooting somebody in the head is deliberate cruelty, or stabbing somebody in the heart may be torture. And as I understood the discussion and the intent of Representative Martin, what he was trying to get at is somebody who, in addition to killing somebody, tortured them. And if you look at the dictionary definition of gratuitous, it has the meaning of unnecessary, and it is that meaning that is intended here, unnecessary to the act of killing. And so I guess I disagree with Representative Bloomberg that it's a lawyer's dream. What is done in the amendment is to more specifically narrow in on the kind of conduct that was intended originally, and to also indicate who makes the finding and by what standard approved. So it is a more specific amendment than what was before you last week.
Yeah, I, Mr. Chairman, I understand, and I gather this other one that's by Representative Martin is not going to be offered.
No, those words, that phrase there again was offered by a lawyer.
We had a bill a couple of years ago, Mr. Chairman, there was the Hudson amendment to the murder one here, and it's AS 1141-100. It was enacted in 1988, and what it says is a person commits the crime of murder in the first degree, and this was added, if the person knowingly engages under circumstances manifesting extreme indifference to the value of human life in a pattern of practice of assault or torture of a child under the age of 16, and one of the acts of assault or torture results in the death of the child. For purposes of this paragraph, a person, quote, engages in a pattern or practice of assault or torture, unquote, if the person inflicts serious physical injury to the child by at least two separate acts, and one of the acts results in the death of the child. And it seems to me, Representative Martin, a simple way, and I would support your concept here, of dealing with this, is to simply say, if the person is 18 years of age or older, and is convicted of a murder of a child under the age of 10, under section AS 1141-100A2.
Chairman, can I respond to that, please?
Yeah, Ms. Otto.
I actually think that that would be problematic with all due respect to Representative Grunberg. The Hudson bill elevated what would otherwise be manslaughter or second-degree murder to first-degree murder in situations that, you know, I really don't have any problem with. But what it would do is if I assault a child one time and break their leg and then shake the child and it kills them, it would mean that I get a mandatory 99 years in jail without possibility of parole, and I think that that is the kind of situation that would put the entire statute in danger of being struck down as unconstitutional and disproportionate. We have already, by making it first-degree murder, elevated the crime up either one or two levels, depending on the circumstances. I think that it also wouldn't pick up the kind of situation that Representative Martin is trying to cover, and that is the person who one time, without having done anything at all before, decides to tie somebody up, a child, yeah, you know, cut their fingers off one step at a time, torture them in some other horrible ways, and then murder them. That is the situation that Representative Martin is trying to cover that wouldn't be covered if you simply took the Hudson Amendment and inserted it into this provision.
Mr. Chairman.
So it's both too narrow and too broad.
Mr. Chairman, I have the difficulty with the term gratuitous torture, and I would propose that is, despite what Ms. Otto has said, and we could ask Ms. Brink from the other side, that's going to just lead to litigation. I would say that if the last two lines of the bill should be clear and convincing evidence, blah, 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 by clear and convincing evidence that the defendant deliberately and intentionally tortured the child and caused his death in that manner, or something like that. What I want to get at is a deliberate and intentional torture of the child that killed the child.
Mr. Chairman, I would object to that because you can torture somebody without killing them.
Right.
Yeah.
But this is for a murder.
But you can. But the way you phrase that is that the torture had to lead to the death, and you can torture somebody without leading to the death.
Right.
Well, okay. But here the and I'm not saying I disagree, but just so you know that this 99 year thing only applies if the death. If the offender caused the death.
Right. Right.
So you're saying
defendant. Why don't we just say
deliberately tortured the child?
Yes, the defendant deliberately and intentionally tortured the victim.
Yes, okay. That the defendant deliberately and intentionally...
Well, Mr. Chairman...
Let me get my amendment out, Lori.
Let him get his amendment straight, and then I'll let you comment, Lori.
Okay.
Deliberately and intentionally tortured the victim.
Okay, that's the amendment. Now, Lori, go ahead.
Okay, if this is what you're going to say, I don't think you need to say deliberately. I don't know what that adds. If you intentionally torture the victim, you I don't know what what Moore saying deliberately adds. So if you're going to make this amendment, I think it should just say intentionally tortured the victim.
Okay, I strike the words deliberately and if that's agreeable with you.
Without objection, it's agreeable.
And then the question I would have for Representative Groomberg, and since he's the maker of the amendment, about something that I think is incorporated in the phrase gratuitous that isn't incorporated in his language, is that we have cases, for example, that suggest shooting somebody in the head is, you know, perhaps torture. Now, I think that what the amendment is trying to get at is torture separate from the act that caused the death. Am I misunderstanding what your intent was?
No, you're not. You are, I'm sorry, you are misunderstanding. I think we made it clear from the interchange between Representative Miller and myself a minute ago that the torture does not have to be separate from a separate act from the act that killed the victim. It can be part, well, let me finish. It can be part of the same act. However, we are not talking about the fact that somebody shot somebody and only wounded them the first time by mistake and then had to shoot him four or five times afterwards. We're talking about an intentional, or I would say a reckless, act as part of whatever happens that is designed to cause extreme pain on the victim and suffering. I mean, maybe, Mr. Chairman, language needs to be worked on a bit. I don't want to delay the bill, but I think that what we're talking about here is a simple concept that they torture the kid.
Mm-hmm. But the question that Lori has is if you put the gun to the kid's head, now if you hold it there for 5 seconds, is that torture? Or if you hold it there for a minute and threaten them, or if you just put it to their head and pull the trigger, is that torture? Somewhere along the line it could be, and by saying, and that's I think what she's saying is, by saying what you've said, it may be interpreted to be torture when you don't want it to be.
And that's where the phrase gratuitously was advantageous, because it made it clear that the torture was not related to the act of the killing. It was something that the perpetrator threw in there to cause pain. Representative Martin?
Well, I'm kind of think we're getting really hung up on all kinds of things. Anytime you torture someone and kill them, that's what I want. Especially we see that with senior citizens more. But that I think we've lessened my major concern here is that anytime someone kills a child, that's not acceptable under murder as first degree murder will be today. So I wasn't necessarily saying that you killed a child under torturous conditions. I was saying that you killed a child, period. The torturous murder came in with adults. I was separating the two.
That's not the way the things are going.
I know it is now. You know, so that's why I said they lessened my true intent. But anytime you kill a child, I don't want you to spend 2 years and $500,000 to say that you really didn't torture the kid.
Do you wish to, this language here, it doesn't seem like it does what you want.
No, it doesn't. I want it simply when you killed a kid under first degree murder conditions, 16 and under, that is 99 years. When you kill another adult under torturous conditions that we have had in the state, that should be 99 years. That's premeditated. That's a far worse crime than shooting a police officer in the emotion of escape.
Okay, so Representative Martin, I think what I'm getting from this is that you'd like to move something a little bit different than this amendment.
Yes, sir, right.
With unanimous consent, we'll just wipe this out from consideration before us. Representative Martin, did you want to move like two conceptual amendments?
The original one, the only hang up they had the other day was manifest deliberate cruelty. That's where we were hung up the other day on those words, and I said I didn't care what you used in there, whatever is legally accepted by what adults say. If you're torturing a senior citizen or someone and you kill them.
So you want it so that any murder that also had gratuitous torture with it would be this mandatory penalty.
Mr. Chairman, I think I know that we're Representative Martin wants to go. I think there would actually be a 3 and a 4. I think the 3 would be fairly easy. It would be insert 3 as 18 years of age or older and a convicted murder of a child under 16 of age. That's that would be Amendment 1. And then Amendment 2 would be regarding the murder of any person under first where you've used torture.
I think that is what Representative Martin is getting at.
Yeah.
So let's take them one at a time,
that's
okay? Let's go with the first one. Okay. Anybody over 18 convicted of the murder of a child under 16? That seems pretty, yeah. Is that what you want?
Well, I'll say that because we get hung up on the emancipated person, 16 and under.
Oh, if you like that, that's what we'll have before us. So let's just discuss that right now. I guess my initial comment was I find that really, you know, something we absolutely want to classify as the most serious, but I'm concerned that it may not be necessarily the kind of thing we want to remove all sentencing discretion from.
What you said the other day, and I didn't mind Mr. Point bringing that in, that a pre-judge panel may have the right to evaluate that.
Yeah, we do have that proposal in here, too. So we would have the opportunity to pass a proposal later that a pre-judge panel could review it and have to sentence.
I would not mind that being a balance of that.
Mr. Chairman, can I make a comment?
Yeah. Go ahead.
I would just like to recount an actual case that I was involved in prosecuting of an 18-year-old and a 15-year-old were cousins who got in a fight over a cassette tape, and the 18-year-old stabbed the 15-year-old to death. Now, the 18-year-old, I convicted him of first-degree murder. I don't think a 99-year sentence in that case was appropriate, and that's what this provision would be requiring. And I would again caution the committee against making these categories where you're imposing a mandatory 99-year sentence without possibility of parole too broad. In situations like this, it's a serious crime, but there is a whole range of conduct that's included within the provision that may or may not be what you're trying to get at.
Mr. Chairman?
Mm-hmm. Representative Groenberg?
I move that we delete sub 1 and we focus on sub 2.
Well, I'm going to rule that out of order. I think we've got a real clear, we don't have any sub 1 or sub 1 before us. Yeah. We've got Representative Martin's proposal to simply say...
But this was what he's back on this. He's back on this one.
Yeah, but we split it into two parts we're going to talk about. Mm-hmm. Right now, all we're talking about is if somebody over 18 is convicted of the murder of somebody under 16. That's all we've got before us right now. Okay?
I see.
Okay. Representative Martin.
I think that she said the balancing act here is the three-judge panel. So that if the original judge and jury have agreed to 99 years, and that seemed unreasonable in that particular case that she's talking about, a teenager that's just 2 months older or a month older than the person he or she killed, then there's an awful lot of closeness there, and that's the reason why the three-judge panel that I think would warrant all the merits of everything involved. However, as you spread the ages, and in most cases this is what's happening, you're getting a 29, a 30, a 40-year-old man that kills a young kid, usually for sexual things or whatever. And that's the one where the mandatory should be in. And that's the one I think the judges will hold up. I was reminded over the weekend of a case where there was a 99-year sentence to someone 21 years of age, and they asked for a review of that, and the judges upheld the lower court, the other judge. Maybe someone can remind us what that case was, but it was a murder involved. Now, I was wondering and thinking of this, well, why did he get 99 years in the first place when it's different? Mrs. Green, do you remember that case last week that just came out and the judge said, and they upheld the 99-year sentence of a 21-year-old person?
The only case that I'm aware of, in fact, there was a case decided last week where they upheld a 99-year sentence, but it was the person who actually did the shooting and the file murder. Or
the that's
contract
the one.
Murder.
The file
I think
murder.
It was a
right.
Different kind of situation than what you're talking about here. I guess I want to correct something. The amendment that we are talking about to provide some relief from the mandatory 99-year sentence is one that would allow the defendant to make a motion to modify his or her sentence after having served half of it without provision for good time. It wouldn't allow, there's nothing in this that would allow for referral of these cases to the three-judge panel. These are ones, you know, and I won't belabor the point, where everybody agrees that everybody who commits those crimes gets 99 years in jail without possibility of parole. And once you get beyond what's in the bill right now, I think that you have a much broader range of conduct.
Well, that's the reason why I'm compromising with you from last week, that maybe the individual cases should be balanced by a three-judge panel within a reasonable time or whenever it's appealed.
Okay. I'd like to go ahead and vote on the proposal that's before us now, and that's to expand the mandatory 99-year sentence to anyone over the age of 18 who's convicted of murder of someone under 60. It's pretty straightforward. Mm-hmm. That's the question. Okay, all those in favor of adding that to the bill indicate by raising your hand. Okay, there's 3 votes for it. All those opposed? Okay, there's 4 votes against it. Motion fails. Mm-hmm. Second part that Representative Martin, you wanted to propose, and let me take a shot at language for you, okay, and then you can just tell me if I'm off. was that anyone who is convicted of a homicide where there was clear and convincing evidence that the defendant subjected the victim to gratuitous torture. Okay. Representative, and you want that before us now?
Sure.
Okay, then that's what's before us. Representative Grover.
I support this, but I have significant problems with the use of the word gratuitous. And I would prefer to say deliberate torture. I move an amendment to the amendment to change the word gratuitous to the word deliberate. And I'm open on something else, but gratuitous is just not a term that I'm aware of having any precedence anywhere in the law.
Okay, does counsel want to comment on that?
Again, Mr. Chairman, I think it was Representative Hanley who was rephrasing my example. I could be mistaken by the voice, but you get into the situation of somebody holding a gun to somebody's head, and the act of murdering them is found by the court to be torturous. I think what you're trying to get at is torture that is separate from the act of killing the person. And that's what gratuitous means. And if there's going to be any debate about it, certainly this record that we're creating right now should be sufficient to allow a court to find that what we're talking about is unnecessary torture that was unnecessary to the act of killing the person.
Well, Lori, what would you say if we just said that? Torture unnecessary to the act of killing the person.
In the act of killing.
Well, yeah. Conceptually, I guess that's okay. I guess I'd probably play around with the language a bit, but I think that's better than saying deliberate torture, which doesn't solve the legal problem that is attempted to be addressed by saying gratuitous torture. So torture unnecessary to the act of killing the person.
That'd be great.
Okay, Representative Grunberg's nodding that that's what he's trying to get at also. Representative Martin, how do you feel about that?
I'm pleased with the gratuitous. Deliberate, I would be worried about. It sounds like we're in the same frame, working towards the same goal.
Okay, and I'm all in favor of making something so you can actually understand it when you read it, too. Mm-hmm. And let's take another shot at what we might have before us then. That the person's 18 years of age or older, is convicted of murder, and the court finds by clear and convincing evidence that the defendant subjected the victim to torture unnecessary to the act of killing or.
Now, I think you're going to have to play with the language, because you could, if you were a depraved individual, kill somebody by torture, and it would be necessary because of the unusual and bizarre method that you kill them by cutting off their fingers and toes one at a time. Yeah, right. So I think that what we're talking about, let me make a suggestion.
Well, I think you're still covered, because even though it was unnecessary, you still did it.
That's right.
So I think you're covered there.
Be careful and realize that the courts are going to construe these statutes very strictly in favor of the accused. And we may understand it, and maybe in some obscure committee minutes, but that ain't going to cut it with a particularly a superior court judge.
Okay, Representative Martin.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Think of that terrible murder of the guy in Spinard and put it up the lane and put him in a violation.
Yeah.
They said that she went to tremendous pain with blood all over her. She was running.
Okay.
Well, I'm not, I'm with you. We just had a draft. Okay. Look, if we can, I think we've got where we know where we want to go here, right? We've got torture that's unrelated to, that wasn't necessary to kill somebody, right? Or when somebody's tortured to death. We feel the proposal by the advocates here is that so serious that we want the judge to mandate a 99-year sentence in that case. Right. So with that, since can we leave it up to our legal beagles to try to come up with something that does that? And with the caveat that Representative Grove doesn't like the word gratuitous. And
would
like
I would like to see
specific.
The language before the bill leaves.
But we vote on the general concept. Well,
yeah.
Oh, yeah. And with the caveat, we bring it back and show it to Representative Grove, too.
I think probably the rest of the committee.
Okay, well.
But at least me. I mean, I don't care about anybody else.
Do you mean you'd like to see the language before?
Let's
yeah, let's. Can we vote on the concept so I can get it?
Sure.
And then get it scheduled. Okay, Lori.
I think that we wouldn't use the phrase as 18 years of old age or older. The reason that we put that in is because we were putting the age of the victim in. So if you're talking about simply torture unnecessary to the act of killing the person, I think it should start with the court finds by clear and convincing evidence.
Got it. Okay. Are we all agreed on that?
Yeah. Representative Mr. Chairman, I was out of the room, and I just wonder, what is the legal definition, Lori, of torture?
Well, there isn't the legal definition. It would be the dictionary definition.
Well, there might be something in black.
what you voted last week, Mrs. Blinker.
Well, in our state, when there's not a definition of the statutes, we rely on the dictionary definition.
Like law?
Okay, and so if we were to decide to do this, it would be whatever that definition is, and any of it, any, even the tiniest amount would trigger the 99-year sentence.
You want to add a caveat that it was a, you know, something more
substantial? I don't know, it just seems like a...
It's a good point.
You got a three-judge panel.
It's no, a good point. No, that doesn't kick in until after 45
that's
years.
That's a potential amendment that we haven't adopted, and it's in 45 years into the future. So.
I think we might be able to reach a consensus here that we want a significant level here before this kicks in. You know, that it's not, you know, one minor act of...
Slapping the face.
Yeah, something like that. I agree with that. I agree with that caveat, too.
It makes it more defensible.
Okay, so we want some sort of... And I know this is going to cause litigation if it occurs, but frankly, I think it's worth it if there's this serious a crime. And a caveat added in there, Lori, that it be a significant level of torture also.
Okay, and am I correct in assuming that we want to limit this to physical torture, or are you attempting to include mental torture as well?
I think we go with physical torture.
Okay, so what I have is, as the amendment, is the court finds by clear and convincing evidence that the defendant subjected the victim to significant physical torture that was unnecessary to the act of killing the victim.
Mm-hmm. The court's already done it.
I have no problem with that, but I am concerned about, except for one thing. Now, I think I'm quite sure, and Ms. Oreski or Ms. Otto can correct me if I'm wrong, that under that language, if you use that, quote, unnecessary, unquote, language, that the court, if you find that somebody actually killed them by torturing them, they might not allow that to be used. You know, so I think that the use of the term unnecessary is going to get you.
We might find another way. Lori, do you understand that concern?
I do, although I have to tell you in all honesty, Mr. Chairman, that I'm a little frustrated because I think saying gratuitous torture eliminates the problem that Representative Grunberg is raising. He doesn't like that language that eliminates the problem, and I will do my best to come up with something, but it is a little frustrating.
Ms. Otto, Lori, I've never heard the use of the term, quote, gratuitously, unquote, used in the law. And if you get into essentially a capital case, and you use a new term, it's Katie bar the door. They're going to be able to use anything they want, a judge, as to what you mean by gratuitously. You come up with some language that's got an established meaning, I'll go for that. I just don't want to come up the whole hog.
Okay, maybe we can go double here and say if the death resulted from the torture or...
Was unnecessary to the act of killing the victim, but then you get into the exact... The problem is that you don't want to have it be somebody who puts a gun to somebody's head and pulls the trigger, and... I would suggest, with all due respect, that we use words out of the dictionary in the statutes all the time. Gratuitous is appropriately and grammatically used in this context, applies a dictionary definition, and I think is capable of being interpreted and understood, particularly in light of this elaborate record of what the legislature intended.
Okay,
well,
I'm looking.
I'm not confused by what it means at all. I think it.
I'm not, but I thought gratuitous meant. If something's gratuitous, you mean you put it on without request. It's like the victim didn't request to be tortured.
Well, I am looking at the American Heritage Dictionary Standard College Edition,
Here it is.
That it's unnecessary.
Given unearned or without recompense, costing nothing, free, not involving a return benefit, compensation, or consideration. Uncalled for, unwarranted.
Well, why don't we just say on the record that the definition for it is the standard dictionary definition number 2, uncalled for and unwarranted.
Right.
You have to question whether any torture is ever called for or warranted.
Well, for the resulting death.
I think that if you say it subjected the victim to gratuitous and significant physical torture, that the court's going to be able to apply that, particularly when it's coupled with a clear and convincing standard. I think any other language really raises a whole host of other problems that you're not intending to create.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah. Margo.
Margo Knuth, for the record. I believe Ms. Otto has indicated to me in earlier conversations that gratuitous comes from an Alaska appellate decision. And the court did not define gratuitous in its opinion, but it used the phrase indicating that it knew what it meant by that it was a meaningful phrase to the court.
Yes, and that is the case at Jones versus State, 765 P. Second, 107, Alaska, 1988.
Hey. What is it? Did you get that, Hayden?
No.
You're too quick for me. 760 Pacific Second, what's the other?
765 Pacific Second, 107, Alaska, 1988, Jones v. State.
Okay.
Jones case, we all know that. Jones.
Well, then this is what I'm going to suggest. We go ahead and vote on with it, using the word gratuitous, sure, with the caveat that we can, on the record, place how we're defining gratuitous, and then we can show that record language later to Representative Grimberg. Can you think about it some more, and we can think about whether we want to fine-tune it later.
Call the question.